Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When marriages, friendships, and families come undone, to what lengths do we go to keep it all together? That question lies at the heart of Brendan Matthews' debut story collection, This Is Not a Love Song. A young mother watches as her desperate husband, convinced a hidden poison lurks inside their walls, tears their home apart. Two journalists bruised by romance and revolution, one a survivor of the Bosnian War, trade tales of lost lovers. A father and a son's haggle over the family business during a high-stakes round of golf, and a lovesick circus clown tries to explain the accidents that bound him to a trapeze artist and a witless lion tamer. The new book is This Is Not a Love Story. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Brendan Matthews, who is also the author of the wonderful novel The World of Tomorrow. Brendan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here, Joe.
It's very nice to have you on the program. I love these stories, and give me a sense as to this is a collection of work that has been around, or that you consciously did this. How did it come about?
These are stories I've written over a number of years. So most of them have already appeared in print in literary magazines probably over the past decade. But in putting them together as a collection, there was a lot of selection involved. So some of the things I've written and published didn't make it the cut. And those that did, I really went back to and did, in some cases, some pretty significant revisions to the stories as they first appeared.
What were you looking for the tone of the collection to be?
I guess there wasn't a single tone that I had in mind. With a collection, sometimes you have these linked collections where you may have similar characters or a similar idea or mood that you want to explore. And then some, the aim is really to just paint a lot of colors. And this one, there's certainly some things that drive it, some interests that drive a lot of stories. You mentioned in the setup that there are a lot of relationships that are being put to the test. And I wanted to see that happen in a lot of different ways. And I wanted to think about different kinds of relationships, friendships, romantic relationships, familial relationships, and just create different environments where those could be explored and tested.
There seems to me, and feel free, please disagree with me if this is the case, but it seems to me there is a melancholy at the heart of the collection.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think there are some stories where humor plays some part, but even then it's more rueful or dark humor.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stories do have some, there's a sense of loss that stalks a lot of these stories. We're either there at the moment that break is happening, or we have a character who's looking back through their past and trying to figure out where things changed or where things went wrong. And that was one of the things, I guess, when I was putting the stories together. I didn't want things that were so tonally different that from story to story, it felt like you were reading an anthology more than you were reading a collection. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense of melancholy. I'd agree.
What does that say about then you as a writer, in the sense of, is that something that you want to explore in the human condition, mm-hmm. or something that you are drawn to? Or something that is a part of you?
I guess it's probably, maybe all of the above. That there are, the stories that I'm attracted to are the stories that I read and the stories that I wanted to tell really get to the heart of relationships. And I think I'm the kind of person who is not always very good in the moment in figuring out exactly how I feel or what I think. And the stories give me time to come back at it over and over again. None of these stories were written quickly. Mm. I tend to take my time, maybe more than I'd like to in some cases, and to figure out how to get it exactly right. And so that act of going back and returning and figuring out how the character would feel in a certain moment, or why someone would do something, why they would sabotage a relationship that they were in, or why they would look back at a certain moment and think of that as being a crucial turning point. I think it's probably something I do in my own life, but the stories give me a different space to think about it and also to think about how other people would do it. I think the thing that is really important to me in any of the fiction that I write is that I'm not that interested in exploring myself or characters who were like me. I want to use writing as a way to try to get outside of me and maybe to find a connection or find a common ground with other characters. But I'm really interested in getting outside my own boundaries and thinking about people who aren't me.
Brendan Matthews is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the collection is This Is Not a Love Song. I would like for you to read a portion of the final story in the collection entitled My Last Attempt to Explain to You What Happened with the Lion Tamer.
He wasn't even a good lion tamer, not before you showed up. He had always looked the part with his whip and his chair and his spangled pants. But honestly, watching him in a cage with those lions was like watching a man stagger blindfolded across a four-lane highway. One night in Glens Falls, the chair slipped from his hand and the lion swatted it around the cage like it was a chew toy. In Council Bluffs, a claw snapped his patent leather bandolier like an old shoestring. And in Granite City, a lion caught the whip between its jaws and yanked him around the ring like a fish on a line. It was a minor miracle every time he stepped out of the cage, bruised and bleeding, his outfit a web of sequins and crooked stitching. He didn't seem to care that the clapping was never the thunderous peal you'd expect when a man emerges from a cage full of wild animals, and he didn't care that it petered out before half a minute was up. He'd just stand there with his arms raised, like some avatar of victory, and he'd beam that ivory smile and shake his blonde mane. You'd think the lions had just elected him the king of the Serengeti.
It's a wonderful story and a great way to end the collection as well. What was the idea of what I was thinking when I was reading the story that, and I don't know this, but it seems that you can't miss in telling a circus story, can you?
No, that was the part. I mean, the story, before I knew what the story was going to be, I came across a book in the UVA library where I was a grad student at the time, and it was full of circus lingo. And I think it was a book that collected slang and argot, cant, all these words that it used for different subgenres, subsectors. It was written in the early part of the 20th century, and it had all this great circus language. And I wanted to find a story where I could use some of those words. So I wanted to get in razorbacks and gillies and all this other great language.
And also the functional versus the dysfunctional of a circus life being a pretty dysfunctional life filled with dysfunctional people, and yet they are trying to be functional in the sense of a relationship.
Yeah, they are. And they're people who have to get out there every night and perform. And when they're under the spotlights, they have to be perfect. And that's an hour a day, perhaps, or less for them. And so I wanted to think about what things really looked like sort of behind the scenes. So we follow them from the big top and then out onto the midway and beyond, and just sort of get a sense of their real lives while at the same time letting them be fully circus people, you know.
You mentioned a moment ago two things that I want to bring together. One was that there is a dark humor here. Also, that these stories take you a while to write. In the humor, what is it like to, if there's something that strikes you funny, does that last, or do you have to work on it so that it stays funny?
Sometimes you get a line down and you just know it's gonna last. You know, sometimes you'll write something in the moment and come back to it and realize that the humor has kind of been let out. I think that the darkest stuff is the stuff that has the most power, has the most charge around it. And that might be, I don't know if that's a result of growing up in a big Irish family where dark humor is the humor. You know,
right.
It's not a light, I mean, there's a lot that's lighthearted about a big family like that. But there's also a willingness to say things because the people know you so well or because you're part of this huge group that everything is subject to humor. And everyone is willing to push things a little farther. Sometimes when, you know, someone new gets introduced to the family, they come away thinking, like, what is wrong with you people?
And it seems that it has consequences, but maybe not till much later.
Yeah. Consequences in what sense? What, the humor has consequences?
Or the you tend to say something and then it's part of the family dynamic, and then it's not till later that you realize just how much of a part of the family dynamic it is.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that comes of a sense that you're all in this together, you know, yeah. in the family sense, people have been together for a long time. And you can say something very small that keys into something much larger, that there's something below the surface and there's a lot of ways into it. You never address the thing directly, but the jokes and the comments might be a way into it. And I think in the stories too, what I tried to get a sense is that the people in these stories very frequently are carrying a lot of history with them. And there's never any way to come at it directly. It comes out accidentally. It comes mm-hmm. out in a small reference. There's a moment where we see a character alone. We realize just how much impact something that was said a few pages earlier really had for them. So there's a slow burn in a lot of cases.
There is a story in the book, as I mentioned in the introduction, a father and his sons haggling over this a business over a round of golf. And it's a high stakes round of mm-hmm. golf. What brought those characters to that green?
I guess where it started, the sense it started with was, I remember writing the story in an early draft, and it had a lot of the same plot details. A father and his sons in the 1970s are playing golf together, and sometimes consciously and sometimes not so consciously are making decisions about their futures. But something about it didn't click. It was all set in the present. And then the first line of that story is, this is a story my father has never told me. And then the story begins. And suddenly I realized the story was more interesting to me if I pulled it back a layer beyond that. So this thing had happened, but it wasn't anyone in the story who was narrating it. It was the son of one of the people who's in the story, and he's imagining how something could have gone. It gave a frame to the story that gave it more weight and allowed me to put it in a kind of perspective. And the story itself is set in a town not unlike where my father grew up. My dad grew up in Rosendale in Kingston. And the town in the story is called Wiltwyck, which is the old Dutch name for Kingston. So it was a landscape that I knew. It was a setting that I knew. I'm one of four brothers, so I kind of know how fraternal relationships can work. And I wanted to think about the way the brothers in that story are entirely united in one moment and at each other's throats the next. How they use humor there too as a way to communicate with each other, often as a way to create some insulation between themselves and the things that they really want to say or the things they're incapable of saying. So there was a bit of family history, and then catalyzed by a little imagination and a sense that the real story might not have been in the moment when they're on the golf course, but the real story might have been the 30 or 40 years since that moment where something's still burning.
Where are you in the birth order?
I'm second.
Mm. That makes a difference, doesn't it?
I think it does.
I'm the youngest of five, so that seems like that makes a difference.
I think birth order makes a huge difference on those things. I think there are personality traits that we ascribe to oldest and to youngest and to middle kids. I guess I'm in the middle, you know, when you're an even number, there's two of us that are technically there. But, you know, they always say that firstborns become presidents and secondborns become revolutionaries.
Seems right.
You understand power and who has it and what it might take to get it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Going back to this idea of the family dynamic and a large family, how much do you think of what you write is a product of that upbringing of? And another way, I guess a much longer way of asking a very simple question, which is of an Irish storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we talked about this a bit when my first novel came out, when The World of Tomorrow came out, that I grew up surrounded by stories, storytelling. You get together with the family and everybody talks about, you know, things that happened 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. That's one of the ways we communicate is we share these stories with each other. And I wanted in on that. And there's a sense in the story that you mentioned, Dunn and Sons, which is set around the golf course, that the narrator recognizes that in his family, living through something doesn't give you the right to tell the story. It's how well you can tell it. So you can sort of steal someone else's story if you can tell it well enough. And that's taken directly from the Thanksgiving table at the Matthews family. You know, one of my uncles has a better take on something that happened to another uncle back in high school. It is his story to tell, and you know, we listen for the details and what gets added. And the other part of it too is as a reader, I mean, I'm a college professor too, and I teach Irish literature sometimes. I teach a lot of different kinds of literature. That was another tradition I wanted in on, And, you know, Joyce's formulation that what a writer needs is silence, exile, and cunning holds true. You've got to listen more than you talk.
Yeah.
You've got to push yourself out of the place where you're comfortable. It doesn't mean going to Trieste or Paris, but it means stepping outside of places where you feel that you know yourself. You've got to get outside that space, and you've got to know what your project is and work hard on it.
You mentioned something in talking about that story with the father and the sons of that looking for that taking a step back allowed it to have a depth. And that's something I found in a lot of these stories of such depth for so few pages. Mm-hmm. And is that often achieved by that decision as to who is going to tell the story and how they're going to tell it? Because there are times in the book where you're, as the reader, you're not sure who is talking to who and what the relationship is it, until it starts to unfold. And that does give it a great depth.
I think so. I think that part of the task of the stories and one of the things that happens in the revision process is trying to figure out who has the greatest stake in the outcome of the story. So the title story, for instance, This Is Not a Love Song, is about a woman named Kat and her sort of rise to fame in the early 90s Chicago indie rock scene. And she's the focus of the story, but she's not the narrator. Because the more interesting story for me wasn't her rise and fall, but the friend who's closest to her who sees it all happen and who thinks about the ways that she was complicit perhaps in the fall or the ways in which she benefited from her friend's brief celebrity and the ways that she wasn't a friend to her. So I think a lot of the work goes into, for me at least, figuring out where that point of view is, where that perspective is, and who's going to feel it the most when things unravel, and to allow them to be the character or the voice who we're closest to as readers.
Brendan Matthews is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the collection is This Is Not a Love Song. I'm struck, and I was continually struck as I was reading the collection, that The World of Tomorrow is a huge novel. Mm-hmm. It's big, and it's great. It's sprawling, and there's so much there, and the nooks and crannies. And it's... So what is it like? I guess I could ask this two ways. One is, what is it like then to have a very smaller canvas and to be able to navigate that? And also then in writing the novel of saying, oh man, I can do all of this, mm-hmm. which seems incredibly freeing.
It was. I wrote short stories before I ever started working on the novel. And so when I first started the novel, it was a little bit terrifying that there was so much space to fill. And then that became a real source of freedom. I was excited to have all this room to explore and not to have to check a certain impulse to let it run.
And my apologies for interrupting, but did you know from the very beginning that you wanted it to be big?
I did.
Okay.
I think I knew from the outset as I started to conceive of the novel that it was not going to be a slim volume, as they say. It was going to be a tome. It was going to be, I wanted to write a big sprawling novel, especially because I had been writing short stories to that point. And I wanted to push the envelope for myself. A lot of the stories, I think if I went back through the collection and tried to put them in the order in which they were written, I frequently would finish a story and then the only task I'd set for myself on the next story was it's got to be different. It has to be a different point of view, a different place in time. It has to be, if it was first person, it's got to be third. If it was a male narrator, it's got to be female. When I got to the novel, I just wanted to use that space and think about how I could really, put my foot on the pedal and push. And when I came back to story writing, and for a while I was kind of toggling between them. I would work on the novel, and if I got stuck, I'd work on a story and vice versa. And then I had committed entirely to the novel. So coming back to the stories was refreshing in a different way. It works a different literary muscle, I guess, to think about how to work in that space. It was a different kind of relief not to have to think about a story and how could I spin it out for 300 pages. I like the discipline of having to feel like I'm accountable for every word that goes into a story in a way that maybe I didn't always feel about the novel. I could pursue lots of directions that didn't have to necessarily factor into the ending, or the ending wouldn't add some color to, where in the story, the way you build towards that final paragraph or two, the thud that the story lands with has to resonate through the entire earlier part of the story. It has to shake up everything you've read, I think, to that point. So there are different expectations and different demands. But I like the ability to work within each of those. And they offer different rewards to me as a writer, and I hope to somebody who approaches them as a reader.
I have been interviewing authors for a long time, and it's the first time I've ever heard it described that way, and I love it, which is that what you just said of being held accountable by the language. That is a fascinating idea to me.
Well, I was lucky enough when I was in grad school, I had Deborah Eisenberg as one of my professors. And Deborah is an exacting writer and an exacting reader and teacher. And other times I had a lot of great teachers. Ann Beatty was one of my teachers, Christopher Tillman, wonderful people who helped me think about story structure in important ways. But in Deborah's workshops, she'd look at someone's story and she'd put it in front of her, kind of run her hand over the page, and then she'd point to the first sentence. She'd say, use the word really in the first sentence. Why? Why really? Why does it have to be really scary? Why not just scary? You think, well, I don't know. And she'd kind of go word by word, and she'd weigh every sentence. And sometimes we'd be there for an hour and a half, and we'd have gotten maybe through the first page. And you'd be in a full sweat by the end of class because you felt like you'd been hooked up to a lie detector. And Deborah is the kindest, sort of most, in some ways, very unassuming person, but also has this real presence about her. And she would just make you think about, not have to explain, but think about why you'd made these choices. And it made me see writing in a way that I hadn't before, I guess, as a series of choices, some of which are really reflexive, and some of which you sweat every minute of, but you should know why all the words are there, what you're striving for.
I've done a couple of events with Stephen King, and there was this one in particular, and we were in the green room waiting to go on stage, and inevitably there's writers who want to share their work with him, so a whole bunch of people came up and they came up with a basket filled with these manuscripts. And while we were killing time, he went through them and just did what you said. I've just read that first page. And I was fascinated because there was a judging there. Mm-hmm. And out of a pile of maybe 20, he took two and said, these are really something. I was fascinated by
based on the first page. That's what he was using as the litmus test.
Of looking through the first page. Mm-hmm. Do you, so a long way of asking the question of, for you as a professor, can you tell early on, can you look at a person's work and say, yeah, okay, this is going to be something special?
I think one thing that some students come to the room with, and some grow into, but they have to love language.
Yeah.
You know, when you're looking at a sentence, some sentences are very workmanlike, or they use too many prepositional phrases to get around to their point, something. But there's an elasticity to the language. There's an energy. There's a sense that the person that you're reading really loves words and loves what they can mean and likes to play with them. I tell my students sometimes that, you know, we always hear this, the phrase, how good artists borrow and great artists steal. And what I think that's... you see a flair for theft in somebody, and that's a good thing. That's a real spark. Because when you borrow something, you're careful with it. So if there's a writer that you admire and you borrow their style, you don't do anything to change it. Like if someone lets you borrow their car, you try not to bang it up too much. But if you steal somebody's car, you can do whatever you want with it. You can hot rod around in it. You can change the color. You can put a lot of aftermarket parts on it. You can joyride and ditch it because your theft allows some sense of freedom, I think, I hope. And I don't encourage my students to steal cars, but I do want them to like think about what they can take from the writers who they like and really sort of supercharge it. And I think that's a thing that you see on the page, that electric sense, that sense that they're willing to break the rules because there's something exciting happening there. Some people come to the world or at least to the classroom with that, and some I hope to push in that direction.
And in the end, be held accountable.
And be held accountable for it, right. If you're going to steal a car, you get caught, you got to pay the price for it, so...
The collection is beautiful. It is called This Is Not a Love Song. It is published by Little Brown. Brendan Matthews, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Joe. I appreciate it.
Again, Brendan Matthews' new collection is This Is Not a Love Song, published by Little Brown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.